Welcome to The Summary, a podcast series by Brian Werdesheim, founding partner of the Summa Group and managing director at Oppenheimer. Brian is a Forbes Shook top 250 financial advisor in the USA, frequent speaker at industry and Oppenheimer events, and a chairman council member at Oppenheimer. Brian's podcast series serves to educate and inspire his listeners by sharing stories and experiences over his 30-year career. In today's podcast, Brian shares his experiences sitting on nonprofit and school boards, as well as his own foundation. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy Brian's shared journey and learn how you too can be a force of good and change simply by paying attention and getting involved.
For the past 25 years, I have enjoyed playing a role in the lives and nonprofits where I could offer some level of guidance, hope, and direction. 23 years ago, I met Dr. Gary Gitnick, who has served as an inspiration ever since. I am dedicating this podcast to Dr. Gitnick because he was the person who more than any other helped shape how I do what I do. His level of humility, grit, compassion, vision, and stop-at-nothing approach was witnessed by many, and it has inspired many like me to do more. 45 years ago, he co-founded the Fulfillment Fund with his beloved wife, Cherna. During his professional life, Dr. Gitnick was a trailblazer in the world of concierge medicine and was the chief emeritus, Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA for several decades. We lost Gary after a courageous battle in 2021, but his legacy will live on forever. And the more than 20,000 students served will never forget how he completely changed the future direction of their lives. God bless Gary and his wonderful family. I'm very proud to dedicate my podcast to Gary, titled Inspiration Through Education and Storytelling. What will be your legacy? Whether Warren Buffett or Melinda French Gates or any other person who's clearly done a lot, you know, in terms of giving back and impacting the world in profound ways, they are all driven by a set of values, and I'm really no different. So I just want to talk about three or four values that have really helped drive my activities over the past 25 years. First of all, I don't think anybody who's reached some level of success has done it alone. Clearly, there were people along the way that provided help. So I kind of feel like anyone who's experienced this level of success is indebted to life until you help someone less fortunate. Until you do, you really haven't done anything. I also believe that philanthropy is learned, and the sooner it's taught, the better. The sooner this begins in a young person's life, the more likely they are going to give throughout their life. I also believe that the philanthropist benefits as much, and if not more, than the beneficiary themselves. I've experienced this firsthand so many times, I cannot count. And maybe most important, and I think this is something that Melinda Gates touches on so eloquently, is that all lives are worth the same, and they should all be given equal opportunities. We do not decide where and when and how we are born into this world, and that in of itself should not determine your fate. I think for anybody, you know, when they get involved in philanthropy, you know, it happens at different times. I always refer to it as kind of like the philanthropic light bulb. It's kind of like, okay, when does this happen? So for me, even though I was observing my parents at a very young age, I was probably about 35 years old. And at this point in my life, you know, I was feeling more stability. I think I was engaged. I was soon to be married. I had a pretty established career. And so as I was able to check those boxes, I was thinking more broadly about my life and about the things that I could do to help impact others and people who just needed help. And so while that's kind of when it really started in earnest, I think it's important to recognize that as a young person growing up in a household, you're definitely watching your parents. And I certainly was watching mine, and there's a few examples of things that I just took note of, you know, as my father was doing little things, and then some bigger things, but like just the simple things like buying uniforms for the high school baseball team or paying for a family to participate in Little League. And then on a more, you know, on a bigger scale, you know, making a significant gift to the Simon Wiesenthal Center here in Los Angeles. And as I was watching this, I'm thinking, you know, this is pretty cool, you know, to see how my mom and dad were thinking about how they could help others. But, you know, for me, 35 years old, I'm feeling pretty good about things, but, you know, I always had an interest in doing things. I just really didn't know how to do it. So the first thing that I did is I reached out to a family friend, Rosalie. And Rosalie, you know, she knew me since I was a little boy, and, you know, she was always somebody who I respected and admired. She, you know, worked in the Gray Davis administration when he was governor, and she ran a couple large family foundations. And so I reached out to Rosalie, and, you know, we went and had lunch and just basically said, look, I really want to get involved. I'm not sure how to do this. You know, there's a few things I'm very passionate about. So she goes, well, Brian, what are those things? And so the two things that stood out were mentorship and education. And so I remember she gave me a list of organizations. I then pursued really a process of due diligence where I called the founders and the CEOs of these organizations and met with them and spoke to them. And at the end of this process, there was definitely one organization that stood out. And I'm happy to say that today that organization is still a very prominent part of my life. 22 years later, I'm still on the board and still very actively involved with this Los Angeles-based organization called the Fulfillment Fund, which is a college access organization. And I'm certainly going to talk a little bit about that later on, just because it's been such a big part of everything that I've done over the last 20 plus years. You know, like I said earlier, you know, when I look back at the evolution of all of my activities, there's just little things that happened along the way. And so, for example, you know, back in 1999, I decided to help the Arthritis Foundation raise money for all the great things that they do. And by doing so, I was given an opportunity to participate and run in the Dublin Marathon in Ireland. Now, while I didn't set any speed records, it was an amazing experience. And, you know, I found it very easy to raise money. I probably raised $25,000 to $30,000, which made me one of the top fundraisers. I got some great recognition at our banquet in Dublin the night before the race. And then I repeated the same thing in, you know, 2007 when I ran in the New York City Marathon. And there I was raising money for Sloan Kettering, which is a prolific cancer research hospital in New York City, just one of the most well-respected in the world, really. And so, you know, that again was just a very positive experience. And so when I think back to all the things that I've done, it's a lot of these little things, they come and go, but it was just so much fun. But, you know, the story that I love to share about the experience running in the New York City Marathon, which in my opinion is the greatest marathon in the world by far, was when I ran by the Sloan Kettering Research Center in Manhattan at probably around mile 20. And I certainly wasn't feeling great, but to see those kids who were all dealing with some pretty serious illness, rooting the runners on as we came by in our orange Fred's Team shirts supporting Sloan Kettering, that was an emotional, but just an incredible experience. The other thing I just want to add is that, you know, when you think about philanthropy, it comes in so many different shapes and sizes. You know, people think of philanthropy as writing big checks or supporting organizations or sitting on boards or, you know, finding a cure for something. It's so much more than that. So anybody who's been a coach, anybody who's been a Little League coach, a soccer coach, a volleyball coach, you know, that's a serious time commitment. And, you know, when I look back at my life and I participated in athletics for a long time, you know, some of these coaches had a huge impact on me. I mean, I do remember certain coaches who took the time, who taught me life lessons. These are people that change the way you see things. And so even though I was coaching Little League for 9 years and just getting a different set of 12-year-old boys and girls each year, I looked at it much more broadly. I really looked at it as an opportunity to not only teach them the great game of baseball, but also using the game of baseball to teach them about lessons of life, failure, and teamwork, and, you know, showing up on time. So is that philanthropy? I don't know. But you know what? It's a way for somebody to make a huge impact on a group of people. And so again, I just want to make the point that it comes in different shapes and sizes in all of my activities, whether running a marathon or coaching a sports team, all falls into this category. But then, like I said earlier, about 1999, I'm thinking bigger and broader. And that's when I got very involved with the Fulfillment Fund. And, you know, initially I was a mentor, got an opportunity to work with some great young kids and kind of help them think differently about what their life might look like. And particularly as it relates to education, because again, we were and are 45 years later, a college access program. And so sitting on that board for 20 years certainly has helped shape a lot of how I look at the world of philanthropy and giving back. And then it's interesting, as that was moving along, one of the things that really started to crystallize in my mind was the question of how could I have more control over where my money was being spent? How could I influence and be more responsible as somebody who was writing checks? And so around 2004, we formed the Summa Children's Foundation. And my dear friend who has since passed, Jim Miles, and I were really at the forefront of this effort. And we were just so excited to build this new organization through our team at Oppenheimer, which was really cool because I think it gave them something that was important above and beyond just coming to work every day. I think it really empowered them and made them feel really good about being a part of our team. And so in 04, we founded this foundation, which was interesting because this was right around the time of Hurricane Katrina, which hit New Orleans. And I remember we were trying to file for our 501(c) status, and there was just a logjam. And it took some time, but we got it. And we ended up, you know, using this foundation as a way for people to give, knowing that we would be responsible in the distribution of whatever money they gave to us. So we really became almost like a vetting mechanism for people who really just wanted to do good, but didn't know where to direct their money. So we ended up doing a ton of research on a number of organizations generally based in Los Angeles, focused in health and education and social issues. And we were just so proud to have, you know, probably handed out, you know, close to $1 million over the course of several years to some really neat organizations. That evolved, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in a minute. But then again, all this stuff is about the evolution and the growth, and kind of I found that as I became more active, I also became more in demand. You know, when people are doing things, they're watching, they're seeing you, they're observing. And then, of course, you know, it gets more challenging because you can't say yes to everybody. But one opportunity that presented itself was to join the Board of Trustees at a private school in Los Angeles. My kids attended school there. And that was a great experience. I mean, that was completely different. Of course, we were involved in raising money, but we were really most involved in just helping shape the future direction of the school. And of course, we always had a say in who was going to lead that school. And so these were, you know, big responsibilities, but it was a great experience. I enjoyed it very much. Now, you know, look, what you're hearing from me right now is like, you know, these different things that have all added up incrementally to help me progress along this path of philanthropy. But I would say in looking back, one of the things that I am most proud of is the Banyan Foundation, which was formed in 2016. And the Banyan Foundation was actually a rebranding of the Summa Children's Foundation. What I found with the Summa Children's Foundation, as great as it was, you know, we kind of wanted to get out of the event planning business. You know, we would put on these large events. You know, one year we honored Coach Pete Carroll, now of the Seattle Seahawks, then of the USC Trojans, and used him in the most productive way to raise millions of dollars for his organization back then, and some other great organizations as well. But we felt like there was a better way, and we felt like we were really looking to innovate and think about a new way of looking at philanthropy. And so when you think about the Banyan Foundation, this was all about empowering the next generation of youth to think differently about how they could make an impact on the world. And so every year we bring in somewhere between 20 and 25 students. They're 9th to 12th graders. They're coming from both sides of the train track. So on one hand, we've got kids coming from some of the best, you know, private schools in America. But on the other side, we've got kids coming from some of the most disadvantaged schools. And to watch the dynamic of these kids over the course of 9 months work very closely together to think about how they wanted to spend philanthropic capital was truly amazing. And so this was a very innovative model that really just transferred the decision making from an adult board to a group of 9th to 12th graders. And so, you know, during the years, they focused on various topics, but it was really interesting to see these groups of kids come together to think about what was most important to them. And I think 1 year, food scarcity was their focus. And so that started a journey where they would basically go out and identify organizations that were committed to this subject, food scarcity and nutrition, and then ultimately, you know, do site visits and do phone interviews and look at financials, and then, you know, give significant amounts of money that was coming from our donors for the Banyan Foundation. And then I think another year, the whole focus was on teen mental health. And what's really interesting about that was probably 2019, more than a full year before the pandemic hit. And I think everybody understands, you know, how timely and how serious problem is as it relates to teen mental health today and in the past, given all the pressures and the social media challenges that kids are facing today. And again, you know, this whole process just continued. And I think, you know, it was great to reaffiliate with my alma mater, USC, serving on the Marshall Advisory Board. And there, that was just more about, you know, being a conduit between the current students and the community. And it was a great experience. Clearly, I'm in the wealth management business. I'm working very closely with a lot of interesting families, many of whom have substantial resources. So I want to talk a little bit about how I advise clients on philanthropic matters. You know, first and foremost, you know, you got to know your client. You've also got to know when it's okay to cross that line. I never want to have a conversation with somebody that they're not comfortable having. But as my relationships evolve and as I get to know them better, I usually get to a point to where I know which ones actually care deeply about the subject, are, you know, pretty philanthropic in their own rights with or without me. And so, you know, my instincts are pretty good. And I am usually, you know, on target with regard to who I can speak with, when I can speak with them. And what I really just try to do is use an educational approach. I think that's the best way, because when you think about the Summa Group, you know, one of the things that we love doing is just educating clients. It's, I think, what we do well, whether it's next generation education on financial literacy, whether it's talking about, you know, college planning or healthcare or succession and multi-generational issues. It's all about education. I don't think philanthropy is any different. So I tend to ask a lot of questions about, you know, what are you passionate about? What do you love? What's concerning to you? You know, if you can make an impact, you know, do you want to do it with your time? Do you want to do it with your wallet? Do you want to do it both ways? And then this inevitably leads to just sharing stories about what I do and how I do it. And I've always found that, you know, sharing stories about my experiences working closely with families and organizations and the beneficiaries of these organizations really tends to resonate. So it's a subject matter that I think is important, but it's also important to know, you know, when it's okay to have that conversation. People who have financial resources, no matter how substantial, they all think about giving differently. And what I think it's really a function of is how structured or unstructured they want to be. And I am going to touch a little bit later on this topic, you know, as I've had some experience on both sides of this. But again, I don't think there's, you know, anything wrong with either. But again, it really just comes down to the rigidity or the structure and how much they want of that. But I'd also say, you know, in terms of thinking about giving, as I referenced earlier, everybody looks at the world a little bit differently. Everybody has interests that have been developed over time because of personal experiences, conversations. Could have been a tragedy, you know, where something happened in a family that brought a topic or a cause, you know, front and center. So I think being passionate about whatever it is that you're going to commit to with your time or money is really, really important. And obviously for me, this was pretty easy because once I, you know, started to focus on education and mentoring, you know, I knew I had found the perfect fit and the rest was pretty easy. Then the other thing, of course, is, you know, what's the agenda? You know, what is this family? What is this individual trying to accomplish? Is it estate planning driven? Is it family empowerment? Or is it just as simple as giving back because it's the right thing to do? There's no wrong answer. But I think, you know, as people start to think about this part of their life, these are the things that tend to drive their decision making. Another, you know, kind of consideration is, do you want to make a general gift? Do you want to make a targeted gift? Now, you know, with the Fulfillment Fund, this, you know, wonderful organization that I keep referring to, in the past, we used to do these wonderful sponsored dinner events where, of course, we'd provide a great program and inspire these folks to the point to where we knew that what we were doing was really important. And ultimately, you know, we got a lot of support at these events, but we gave them the option of sponsoring a student mentor team or funding scholarships. And so that's a targeted gift, right? That money was going to go to a very specific use, which was great. The Summa Children's Foundation, right? When we were doing this early on, we enjoyed making targeted gifts because the size of our individual gifts were not huge. They weren't insignificant, but generally between $10,000 and $75,000. And a perfect example of a targeted gift that we made back in the, you know, probably about 1995 was to the Rape Treatment Center at UCLA. And our gift was for the purchase of forensic equipment that was required and needed desperately to examine some of these young victims. And it was gratifying. We remember we did a visit. We got to see the equipment at the center here in Santa Monica. And at the end of the day, we knew exactly where that money was going. So again, you know, these are just some of the things that I tend to talk to clients about in terms of what you should be thinking about as you begin your process of giving. Now, when I look back at people who are doing great things, there certainly are some common approaches of people who do it right. And, you know, look, there's, like I said earlier, there's no right way or wrong way, but I think you have to be mindful and thoughtful about what you're doing. One individual in particular, I'll just refer to him as Stan. He's a very well-known money manager, and I've been watching his activities over the last 25 years because he's a close family friend. And, you know, watching him, what I really think about first and foremost is how thoughtful, structured, and disciplined he is. You know, he's focused in a few areas. For example, education is a huge thing. Stem cell research, cancer research. So his family foundation is dedicated to really understanding who in those respective areas are doing the most impactful work. And not just from, you know, from a practical standpoint, but also from a financial standpoint of responsibility. So these types of people have a process to ensure that the most deserving organizations are getting rewarded both from a qualitative and quantitative perspective. Look, the reality too is a lot of people just don't have the time or resources or maybe even the interest to do all this work. And so there are organizations out there who help major donors find incredibly impactful opportunities. There's an organization in Santa Monica, California, Focusing Philanthropy. Larry Gilson, former partner at Oaktree Capital, started this over a decade ago after his retirement. I really am not aware of a more impressive organization that has established a mechanism whereby people can make gifts to specific targeted areas all around the world. One example, which I think is just amazing, is an organization that helps people in Africa and Asia and Latin America for $50, a procedure is completed and eyesight is restored in 24 hours. These are people who haven't seen for a long time. It might be cataracts, it might be some other thing, but for $50, you're restoring eyesight to millions of people at $50. So Focusing Philanthropy has the ability and has boots on the ground all over the world. So whether it's clean water, whether it's education, whether it's underserved women, you name it, they are about as good as it gets. And so I have actually sent a number of my clients over the years into focusing philanthropy. They've done trips with them. They've gotten to see firsthand how their money's being spent. So I think for someone who doesn't want to spend all this time and energy, I think an organization like Focusing Philanthropy is a great option. But then look, I mean, on the other end of the spectrum, you just want to support something because it's important to somebody else. I mean, how many times during the course of a year do you get asked, hey, Brian, look, I'm involved with this organization. I love what they're doing. It's really important to me, and I'd really appreciate it if you'd support it. There's nothing wrong with saying yes every single time. You know, that's kind of the way I approach it. I mean, when I have someone come up to me and say, hey, look, I'm raising money for, you know, for cancer research, or I'm raising money for a school or a sports program for underprivileged kids, I'm going to write the check because it's important to them. And I want to help them do what's clearly a passion for them. So again, advising and watching how people give, I've seen all different ways, and there's no best way, but I just think it's great to see all the different variations. One of the conversations that I have with families who are now thinking about giving is, you know, the different structures that are in place. And the two most popular that I've seen, one being a donor advised fund, or a DAF, which is what many refer to it as, or a family foundation. These are two very commonly used structures, but they're completely different. And so I just want to touch on the differences between the two. You know, a DAF, or a donor advised fund, is ideal for those who just want simplicity. There's been tremendous growth in this area over the last 5 years. Every major firm on Wall Street has made it very easy for their clients to set up a DAF, fund it, get the immediate tax benefit, let it grow tax deferred, and then make targeted gifts, you know, until that money is depleted. This is a phenomenal development in the world of philanthropy that has grown astronomically over the 10 years. And I think it's just the ideal situation for somebody who wants some control, but doesn't want to be overwhelmed with the structure and the responsibility and the cost of running a family foundation. Family foundation is really ideal for those who want structure, they want process, and maybe most importantly, they're interested in building a legacy of giving within their family structure. You know, maybe you have children and grandchildren, and maybe you want to empower them with board seats and decision making. Now, when you think about how to do this, it's usually through responsibility and accountability. Now, look, I think it's great. I think that families who have some of these objectives, the family foundation can be great, but it's important to note that they're expensive to maintain, more expensive certainly than a donor advised fund. It requires a pretty significant commitment of time and resources. You know, you need to have board meetings on a regular basis. You need to have minutes. And again, it's just it's a whole other layer. But the good news is that it certainly helps create a lasting legacy of giving. And it certainly is a powerful educational tool for the next generation. People ask me all the time, like, hey, should I write the check? Should I donate my time? Like, what's better? Well, look, the simple answer is both are better, right? I mean, you know, if you can write the check and you can also give your time, that's the best of all worlds. But that's not always practical. And so some people are just way too busy. And certainly, you know, if you're raising a family, you've got young kids, you've got a job that's taking a lot of time and other things that are pulling at you. The reality is you just don't, maybe at a particular time in life, have the ability to donate your time. But I've got so many examples where the impact that's been made is so tremendous, and it involved no out-of-pocket expense for that person. For example, you know, again, back to the Fulfillment Fund, you know, for many years, we had a very prolific, you know, one-on-one mentor program. And that's just an amazing opportunity to spend time with a young person, usually a 15, 16, 17, 18-year-old, who's coming from probably a family where both parents might be working, or it might be a broken family in a pretty severely disadvantaged economical situation, probably not getting the level of education they should. Conversations probably not happening at home the way they happen in maybe a more healthy home situation. And so a mentor is matched with these students, and they're just helping them experience things they've never experienced before.
And it, you know, that in of itself is maybe better than writing a check, because it's really this change happens one life at a time. And whether you're helping one life or 10 lives or 1,000 lives, it doesn't matter. Coach Art, I mean, another amazing organization that I've been supporting for close to 20 years and who is a primary beneficiary at one of our events, Xander Lurie, recognized years ago when his father was going through cancer treatments that there were a lot of kids hanging around who were also going through treatments who had nothing to do. And the families and the siblings of these families were really challenged with this entire dynamic. So Coach Art was his solution for bringing together coaches in the athletics and the arts and pairing them with kids who are chronically and terminally ill. And it was so so much fun for me to watch the growth of this organization. But these coaches that come to Coach Art, I mean, it's a minimal outlay of time. This is not about writing a big check, but this is about maybe an artist or a soccer coach spending time with one of these kids to help break up the mundane and you know, painful kind of nature of their existence as they're going through treatments. It's just so, so great. Camp Harmony, I mean, Camp Harmony for kids coming from broken homes. A lot of, you know, kids who are foster kids get to come to camp every summer. How about being a counselor at Camp Harmony? I mean, one of my partner's sons has been doing it for years, and it's the best thing he does every summer. Again, no outlay of money. And then, of course, like I said earlier, Little League coach, soccer coach, swimming coach, golf coach. This is philanthropy. This has nothing to do with writing checks. This just has to do with giving your time and giving of yourself to help improve the quality of life and maybe give some young man or young woman some direction. A lot of times people ask me, you know, where do I start? Where do I begin this process of identifying, you know, nonprofits? And, you know, I always tell them, I go, look, with the advent of technology and, you know, of course, what's happened with, you know, the digital era, the availability of information today on nonprofits has never been greater. I think there's about 1.8 million nonprofits in the United States today, which tells you there's a lot going on, right? But at the same time, that can appear to be overwhelming. But, you know, I think if you're just paying attention and you're just seeing what's out there, I think it's pretty easy to figure out, you know, where to go from there. But again, you know, there's rating agencies or sites where you can go on and these nonprofits get a score based on their financial stability, their responsibility, their impact, their success, their outcomes. So there's certainly qualitative and quantitative resources available to anybody where they can punch in a subject matter and out will come a number of organizations that might be a good fit for them. But, you know, I think once you understand where your passion is, I think it's pretty easy to start asking questions, you know, whether it's family, whether it's business associates, whether it's the internet, to start building this knowledge that can ultimately be used to make some decisions as to where to get started. When it comes to philanthropy, I mean, not everybody is equipped to be a fundraiser, right? It's not easy. Some people are just uncomfortable with the idea of asking somebody to give, you know, and I just don't feel that way. I feel like, again, like I said earlier, I think it's incumbent upon anybody who's done anything in life to understand that they didn't do it alone, that until they give back, they really haven't done anything. So I think there is an art and science of fundraising. And I, you know, I use both to my collective advantages to help get support for a number of important causes that I'm very passionate about. And I would say that the mindset is key. And what do I mean by mindset? It's just the way you think about philanthropy. I mean, it's kind of like what I said earlier, you know, with regard to my values. You know, my values drive my philanthropy and my mindset is driven by those values. And I also believe that most people are looking for great things to support, but they just simply don't know what to do. I was at an event probably 10 years ago, the Beverly Hills Hotel, and this guy, Stan, that I referred to earlier, who's given away billions of dollars to a number of very important areas, is standing in front of a large crowd of about 600 people. And he's simply asking them, what are you going to do when you die? Are you going to swim with all this money in your coffin? And I just sat there and watched this guy, and I watched the people in the room. And he was obviously not completely serious, but the messaging that he was giving to these people was that, look, you're here for a limited time. You have the ability to make an impact. What are you waiting for? It's time. And I fed off that. So like when I was sitting in that room, I'm like, this guy is so right. So I think it's really important from a mindset perspective to just embrace the notion that it is incumbent upon those who are successful and who are wealthy, didn't do it alone. And they have a huge responsibility to give back. And I just feel that, you know, at the core. And I think the thing that is an unintended consequence of giving, and I guess this is just something that anybody who's done anything in this world as it relates to giving back understands, and that is that the donor very often benefits as much as the recipient in this transaction of giving. I know that I've experienced this just so many times, and I think it's powerful and it's real. When I think about Rosalie and I think about this woman, you know, who I've been watching for a long, long time, and I think about her approach to fundraising, when my phone rings and, you know, and I know it's her on the other line, I'm just not asking myself if, I'm just asking myself how much am I going to have to send to her to satisfy her request for money for usually what is a great organization or cause. And so when you, like Rosalie, believes in what you believe in, you're going to take out your checkbook and you're going to be happy about it. So I kind of look at it that way. And I realize that a lot of people who do fundraising, they can't get there. But I think there's a lot of different ways to fundraise. And again, you know, the art of it, the science of it, it's fascinating to me. And I think you do whatever works for you at the end of the day. Social impact investing is a area that's growing very rapidly. As I'm speaking today, talking about billions and billions of dollars is now finding its way into organizations that are going to have some social impact on the world. And so what is social impact investing? I mean, it is investing, but I want to clarify that the people that I've watched execute on this area, their primary objective is to not make money. They call it investing, but really what they're trying to do is to support and help build a sustainable franchise that can do good. And if they happen to have a return on their capital, that's just icing on the cake. It's really not what's driving them. And there's just so many examples of social impact investing, you know, around the world. But I had a personal experience with this a number of years ago, and pretty cool story. There's a founder of a company out of Colorado, and he had this idea that he was going to help eradicate energy poverty around the world, particularly in areas where they were just off the grid, where people would walk 3 hours a day just to charge their cell phone. And he created this technology that allowed this device, this panel, to stream the sun directly into a mobile handset. And so people in Africa all of a sudden were able to charge their phone without going through what was a lot of work. Now, unfortunately, as technology and cell phones changed and as batteries became faster and more powerful, this technology almost became obsolete overnight and the company did not survive. However, the silver lining is that it created an awareness for energy poverty, if you want to call it that. So when I think about the people that were behind this, they were so well-intentioned and they wrote some pretty large checks, but I think they were still satisfied because they felt like they raised awareness to a really significant and serious issue. As I shared earlier, I do very strongly believe that the sooner philanthropy starts in a young person's life, the better. And I also think that philanthropy is a learned exercise. Now, it is true that some people, it's embedded in their, you know, in their DNA. You know, it's unexplainable. It's just the cosmic universe at work. And, you know, even whether or not they grew up in a family where this was happening, they still just are, they're that person from an early part of their life, right? Instilling values of philanthropy in young people, I mean, I think the family obviously has a lot to do with it. You know, and I think that any young person is influenced by the people around them. I shared earlier, you know, how I was certainly influenced by my parents, watching them do little things that, you know, I think had an impact on, you know, different types of people. But again, you know, when I think about why I
rebranded the Banyan Foundation, the driving force behind that was I had this strong desire to provide this next generation of givers with the tools and the resources to think differently about how they can make an impact. So empowering this next generation with this knowledge was powerful because, you know, typically when you look at a foundation, it's an adult board. You know, they're meeting, they're making decisions, figuring out how to push forward the agenda, the mission of the foundation. But what we did with Banyan is we transferred that decision-making, we transferred that power to this young group of really smart people. And so it was really fun to watch how over the course of 9 months that they started to realize that, wow, you know what, we can do this. And so I think you just, it's through education, it's through awareness. I think these kids are all, you know, very different. And I think if you can give them access to knowledge and information, I think they'll be well on their way. You know, young people, as it relates to giving back, I mean, it's never too early and it's never too late. And like I said, I mean, for some kids, it's kind of dialed into their DNA and that's a wonderful thing. But I think everybody has a different path. And I think even when I look at my own kids who are now 18 and 19 years old, they're fairly aware of their surroundings. And I think that's a huge thing. I you know, when I speak to my Banyan kids, I always tell them, I go, look, pull your head out of your phone and just look around and see what's going on around you. There is a lot of suffering going on. And there are so many things that you can do during the course of a day to make the life of somebody around you better. And it's not complicated. I mean, it might be helping an older person walk across the street. It might be helping somebody load their groceries into the back of their car. But it's like, or just recognizing or saying something nice to somebody when they need it the most. I mean, this is what I'm saying. Like, philanthropy is just improving the lives of those around you. This isn't a narrow definition. This is a way of life. It is a mindset. It's an approach to not only enriching the lives of those around you, but enriching your own life almost selfishly. And I got to tell you, it feels good. And the more you do it, the better. And it's also, you know, going to help feed this next generation with the motivation to continue on this path. So again, I mean, it's a long answer to talking about how early young people should get involved in giving back. But I just think it's in order for them to do it, they've just got to be paying attention. That's really what I'm saying here. When I think back to the time in which I really started to get involved with different organizations, whether it be a nonprofit or a school board or my own foundation, you know, I'm obviously very proud of the work that we've done. But when people ask me, you know, like, what are you most proud of? And it doesn't necessarily relate to any one of those seats on a board or acting as a trustee at a school or the money that we've spent on different things that we're very proud to have supported over the years. I think what I really get down to, it's the individual people that I've been able to see benefit from some of these activities. Right. And, you know, I've always been excited about meeting, you know, younger people who are doing great things or younger people who just need a push. And so I love to tell a couple of stories and I'm going to do that right now. There's three or four stories and I'd love to end with just kind of sharing with you, you know, why what we do is so important. And you never really know how it's going to go. But back to the Fulfillment Fund, I think, you know, 15 or so years ago, I was at our annual College Achievement Awards. This is where we honor our graduating high school seniors every year. And it's a fairly important event. And a lot of times it's like, you know, the first time these kids are seeing so many people gather to help support them as they move on to this next phase of life.
as they matriculate to college. But I remember sitting in the room, and randomly I was sat next to a young man named Raphael, and Raphael came from, you know, South Central Los Angeles, not a great area. And, you know, he sits down with me and my wife, Janelle, and he starts talking to us. And I'm like, wow, this guy's impressive, you know, and he's talking about how the Fulfillment Fund has helped him think differently about college. And I'm like, that's so cool. A couple of weeks later, I get a really nice handwritten note from Raphael. He says, Brian and Janelle, so great to meet you. Anyway, this led to me reaching out to him, and that began a series of lunches. And of course, I introduced him to my father, and they developed a great relationship. And so Raphael graduated from USC Business School, you know, was recognized for just about every academic award that you could imagine. And this is a young man who really had no parental support, lived from house to house, car to car for much of his young life, but somehow found a way to get to USC, graduates, goes to work for Deloitte for a couple of years. They lay off the entire workforce at some point during the financial crisis of 08. He decides to go see 75 countries for a couple of years, and then at the same time decides to apply to business school and is admitted to HBS, Harvard Business School. And I was just so proud of him. And, you know, we're in contact through this entire process. Well, a quick 3 years later, I guess, what, 2 years later, 3 years later, when his program at Harvard ended, get an invitation in the mail inviting me to attend his graduation at Harvard Business School. And I got to tell you, I got on that airplane. I went to Cambridge with my father and one of his professors from USC. I watched Raphael Anderson walk, and it was one of the greatest days of my life, a beautiful, sunny May day in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on the campus at Harvard, of which I had never been to before. And as I was sitting there watching him, I realized that had I not been there, nobody would have seen Raphael Anderson receive his MBA from Harvard Business School. Not his mother, not his father, not a sibling, not a friend. Now, certainly he developed an amazing group of friends while he was there. But, you know, it was just so interesting to think that I was there and I got to watch this guy benefit from people like me and so many others supporting him, you know, on his journey. It was powerful. The other story I love to tell is R. Lil. R. Lil was an eighth grader. He came and spoke at one of my events in the early days of the Summa Children's Foundation. And, you know, he shared his story about how one day he dreamed of being at a school that had a library and a cafeteria and a place to study and a place to be around other kids who cared as much about education as he did. And he, too, came from just a really challenged background with parents who were either incarcerated or using drugs, and in a really, really bad area of Los Angeles where the school system was just broken. Well, he spoke at our event for about 15 minutes. When he was done, the head of a very prominent prep school here in Los Angeles came up to me and R. Lil and said, "Where are you going to go to school? Where are you going to go to high school?" And he's like, "I'm not really sure." He goes, "Well, we'd like to give you a full ride to this school," which meant that they were basically giving him about $250,000 to attend one of the most outstanding schools in Los Angeles. And that happened. And that just happened because I happened to have had an event, he happened to speak, and we happened to have had the right person in the room. That's amazing stuff. Those are unintended consequences. So when you ask me what I'm most proud of, it's stuff like this. And then I think about Marco Hernandez, who now works for City National Bank here in Los Angeles. And Marco, I met because he spoke at one of our events, and he was just so articulate and so impressive. I'm like, I've got to know this kid. So we developed a great relationship, and I learned quickly thereafter that he was really struggling with paying for college. And so I found a donor who ended up paying his tuition to finish his college experience. He no longer had to worry about where that money was coming from. And so again, these are the little things that I've been able to experience. And then, you know, one story that just falls into the category of being aware, you know, I play golf at this place here in Los Angeles, and there's been a guy there working there for like 8 years. And every time I see this guy, I just go, wow, he's so positive. He's so friendly. He's so helpful. He's educated, but he's working as, you know, a guy that helps, you know, around the golf course. And I'm like, what is going on here? Right. So I started asking him some questions. I said, "Martine, I go, what do you want to do?" He goes, "Well, I just love to have an opportunity. I just need a break." So introduced him to the folks at Oppenheimer in Los Angeles. He started the interview process. And lo and behold, as we speak today, he is a full-fledged employee of Oppenheimer in Los Angeles, working in operations. And that's great stuff. So when I'm asked, you know, what am I most proud of? These are the stories that really drive me. These are the things that motivate me, that inspire me, and that I hope to use to inspire others to do so many great things. And all you got to do is just really pay attention. Somehow find the time every day to think about what you can do to help someone else the same way that you were helped at some point along your path and journey.